Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Crocher. When it comes to the question of climate change, you might wonder if there's anything new under the sun. Well, the Alberta Ingenuity Fund offered up some hope on the science and solutions front at its recent symposium in Edmonton. Among the rising stars on the climate change horizon are David Keith and David Lazell. One talks about emissions-free fossil fuels, and the other about agriculture and the new biomass economy as means to dramatically lower the greenhouse gases going into the atmosphere. And on the forest front, Marc-André Viard of the Sustainable Forest Management Network discusses his research to protect biodiversity on intensively managed land. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Canada's pending ratification of the Kyoto Protocol has put climate change on the front burner as far as political agendas go. Scientists and various agencies have been investigating climate change issues for many years, decades in fact. Despite this, there seems to be a lack of knowledge among the general public about the science of climate change and some of the solutions to excessive greenhouse gas emissions. That's one reason why the Alberta Ingenuity Fund assembled some experts in the field of climate change to meet for a day-long symposium in Edmonton. Dr. Bill Bridger is the president and CEO of the Alberta Ingenuity Fund.
Our legislative mandate requires us to make an effort to improve the scientific literacy of people of the province, and so this is an area where like everyone would benefit from that kind of literacy and understanding of the underlying science on an issue as important as and as controversial as climate change. The other one is, from our point of view, we have some dollars to invest. They're limited dollars. And a meeting like this helps us to identify areas of research that are emerging that are of potential importance to the province. And so it's given us a lot of insight as to where we might make some investments in the future.
How did you decide on your speakers? Because you've certainly drawn from a wide range and areas that a lot of people haven't necessarily heard from.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the three things that we wanted to do was to provide a really balanced view of the science of climate change. And so we've deliberately avoided the extreme elements and gone to people that we know are, I mean, authorities. I mean, members of the Canadian delegation to Kyoto, for example, on the underlying science. The second issue was solutions, and so there I talked to a lot of people. I'm a biochemist, so I don't know who these people are, but I talked to a lot of people about the two obvious solutions, one being creation of biomass, and the other some kind of physical or geochemical sequestration of carbon, and found the best people that we could. It turned out that the rising star in the latter field was an expatriate Canadian, and wouldn't it be great if we could get him back?
What have you learned from what the speakers have had to say today?
I think what I've learned is the degree of consensus and convergence in all of this, that the time has come, protocols or not, for us to do some things differently. There's tremendous opportunity for research. I think that ultimately there's jobs that will be created as we attack the problem of greenhouse gases. And I think that this will help us to continue to be, sustain our ability to be a wonderful place in the world in which to live.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I was speaking with Dr. Bill Bridger, President and CEO of the Alberta Ingenuity Fund. At the heart of the climate change debate is our global dependence on fossil fuels. With our present technology, burning coal, gas, and oil releases excessive amounts of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And this is accelerating the climate change cycle. Dr. David Keith is that expatriate Canadian that Bill Bridger referred to. David Keith now teaches engineering and public policy at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. He believes we're much further ahead than we think. We have the technology to use fossil fuels without enduring CO2 emissions. The issue then is using the tools we already have in our toolkit.
Specifically, with respect to the idea that we could use fossil fuels without emitting carbon dioxide, of course, there are other ways in which you can deal with the CO2 emissions problem, such as wind or solar power or using biomass, and all those also were tools. But I was talking mostly about the idea that we could use fossil fuels without CO2 emissions. And even there, though people have thought less about that, we have a bunch of pieces in the toolkit. For example, we know how to make hydrogen at huge quantities and easily capture the CO2 from it. And so in that way, we can generate hydrogen, a kind of energy carrier that can be used to make electricity or to power cars while capturing the CO2. And every part that I just said is now available, in fact, in Alberta. There are hydrogen production facilities in the oil sands that have pure CO2 vents, so they already effectively separate CO2 from hydrogen.
Where would that CO2 go?
It could be put deep underground, as it is now put deep underground in some places to enhance oil recovery, using essentially the same technology. So it could be transported in pipelines and injected a kilometer or more underground, as is already done today in Canada, most notably at the Weyburn Field in Saskatchewan.
How realistic is it to look at these sorts of technological fixes?
I think it's completely realistic to look at it. I think it's very likely from what we know now that we will want to do a significant amount of it. But the question of how much we should do, what the risks are, how to balance doing this, that is using fossil fuels without CO2 emissions compared to other things we might do are hard questions, which I don't have an answer for. Clearly, to deal with a climate problem needs lots of different parts.
One of the things that you also mentioned was that while there's a lot of public focus on dealing with emissions coming from cars and also using, changing our fuels to fuel cars, that actually that's the wrong place to start. What do you mean?
In fact, first of all, personal vehicles account for less than a fifth of CO2 emissions, roughly. The transportation sector is a little more, but if you just count personal vehicles, cars and SUVs, you're only talking about a fifth or so of total CO2 emissions. And that turns out to be one of the most expensive fifths to get of the entire economy. This is completely independent of what I was talking about with CO2 capture. And so if you were going to deal with rational climate policy and were going to start with the cheapest things first, which is what a rational person does, you wouldn't, in fact, start dealing with cars for a long time.
Where would you start?
Let me amplify my comment anyway. You don't have to trust my academic's opinion. The carbon prices, the carbon taxes that already exist in Europe and to some extent in Canada amount to hundreds of dollars a ton of carbon already in terms of gasoline taxes for personal cars. And we don't see hydrogen-powered cars. So what that means is the price of reducing CO2 emissions by hydrogen-powered cars must be over those hundreds of dollars a ton of carbon. Yet that amount of money, that amount of carbon price or tax, would get us dramatic reductions in the electric sector or industrial sectors.
So you'd start with electricity rather than vehicles?
I'd start with the industrial and electric sectors. And in vehicles, the obvious thing if you want to reduce emissions is to increase vehicle efficiencies or to get people in smaller vehicles. But I wouldn't start with radical new technology in the automotive sector.
We've been talking about climate change and things that could and should be done or whether it even is a problem for a number of years. And we're still talking. When are we going to start doing things?
Who knows? I think soon. The climate problem has been on the agenda for 40 years. And over the last couple decades, it's been more and more seriously on the agenda, to the extent that now, for the first time, there are some countries in the world where people are beginning to not just talk, but actually act, to spend real money, endure a real small amount of economic pain to actually reduce CO2 emissions. The European Union is doing that to some extent, and Canada is likely going to start. And so I think the answer is we will start doing it for real in the next decade.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. David Keith, professor of engineering and public policy at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. While carbon dioxide emissions garner most of the blame for climate change, there are several other greenhouse gases that we must pay attention to. These include nitrous oxide and methane. And as Dr. David Lazell is quick to point out, they're among the reasons why agriculture has a big role to play in mitigating climate change. David Lazell holds a research chair in biology at Queen's University, and he is the founder and research director of BioCap Canada Foundation.
Well, nitrous oxide and methane are two very potent greenhouse gases. Methane's about, each molecule of methane is about 21 times more potent in warming, in absorbing infrared radiation, essentially, and warming the Earth's atmosphere than as compared to carbon dioxide. Nitrous oxide is about 310 times more potent than carbon dioxide. So even though these gases are produced in much, much lower concentrations and or quantities as compared to carbon dioxide, they still contribute a significant amount to, thought to contribute a significant amount to greenhouse gas and to our climate change.
Where did they come from?
Nitrous oxide is a greenhouse gas that comes from industrial processes and also agriculture. Methane comes from basically pipelines, methane pipelines, and from agriculture. Now, in Canada, the agricultural emissions of nitrous oxide and methane are quite significant. They account for about 10% of Canada's greenhouse gas emissions. Nitrous oxide primarily comes from the unused fertilizer, that nitrogen fertilizer that farmers put on. Some of it, the soil microorganisms can convert some of it into nitrous oxide and it escapes to the atmosphere. And therefore it counts for, essentially by itself, it counts for about 5% of Canada's greenhouse gas emissions. Methane comes from cow burps, basically, when cows have a rumen, which is an anaerobic digestive system to digest the plant food that they eat. And if they're balance of that food, the composition of that food isn't perfectly balanced, you can get a certain proportion of that food gets converted into methane gas and comes off as to the atmosphere.
Are there things that can actually be done in order to reduce those? I'm having a hard time thinking what you could do with the cow.
There are a lot of things that can be done to reduce emissions from agriculture. Some of the practices are already understood of what can be done. They're changing the way one manages fertilizer applications in agricultural cropping systems, or perhaps changing the way you manage the animal production process or the manure management issues can all reduce emissions of methane and nitrous oxide. What we don't have a very good handle on at the present time is how certain best management practices how much they reduce methane emissions or nitrous oxide emissions associated with agricultural regions of Canada. We have some idea, but we don't have very good numbers on the magnitude of the emission reductions. We don't understand all of the processes that are involved either in generating nitrous oxide or methane in different agricultural systems. So certainly we know some of the things can be done. We can start moving in that direction. We need to quantify it better. And then we need to develop new technologies, new management strategies, and new animal production or cropping system technologies that will result in very significant reductions ongoing into the future in nitrous oxide and methane emissions.
One of the things that you've also introduced is this idea of the bio-based economy. Now, what would form the basis of a bio-based economy?
Well, a bio-based economy is really in some ways in contrast to a fossil fuel-based economy, which we are now. About 80% of our energy, chemicals, materials come from fossil fuels at the present time. In a bio-based economy, we'd be shifting from using essentially 300 million-year-old plants, which are what we are fossil fuels, to the use of 30-year-old plants or annual biomass crops, etc. Or what the big opportunity now in Canada is to look at the waste carbon stream that comes off our existing agricultural and forest production. That would provide the biomass, essentially the plant and animal materials that are the waste materials that are coming off of our agriculture and forestry, and converting them into liquid fuels like ethanol or biodiesel, into perhaps hydrogen gas that could be used in fuel cells, using to produce commodity chemicals that would produce everything from paints and varnishes, etc., to use them to produce materials like plastics and bio-based plastics instead of getting the plastics from fossil fuels. This is a basic using renewable energy and renewable materials to provide these energy chemicals materials for society rather than having to rely 100% on fossil fuel-based feedstocks.
Are these things that are already happening?
Certainly it's very early stages, and I don't think biomass will ever provide outcompete fossil fuels for sure. Fossil fuels are going to be a very valuable feedstock into the future, but there are certainly some bio-based feedstocks which could contribute and are contributing now to our energy, chemicals, and materials, and we see the early stages of it. Ethanol is now made largely from starch, but it's possible with some technologies, some Canadian technologies have been recently developed, to see ethanol being made from cellulose and waste carbon coming off of agriculture. So basically the plant residue, if you like, that's left after the crop is taken.
Do you see there being a competition, however, between using the biomass for food or fuel, that they will compete with one another?
I think that we've got a long way to go before that's a problem. Right now, for example, in Canada, the waste carbon stream coming off of agriculture, forestry, municipal waste has sufficient energy in it to provide as much as 25% of the current energy chemicals and materials we now get from fossil fuels. So that's without, we've got a lot of way to go, long way to go before we actually have to think about planting biomass crops and trees in order to generate the feedstocks for a bio-based economy. And I think that eventually there may be an opportunity or maybe some need to plant special biomass crops. But there's a lot of farmland in Canada which is not being used, and there's a lot of forest productivity which could be used in that way, as long as it can be done in a sustainable way and make sure that the end product is renewable and sustainable.
Are other countries moving in this direction as well?
Yes, absolutely. The United States is moving very quickly in this direction. Now, the United States, the driver isn't so much a climate change driver. It's an energy security driver. What happened on September 11th, 2001 has caused the American public to be very concerned about where they're getting their energy from. Their dependence on Middle East oil is very high, and it's increasing every year. They're looking at ways of home growing their energy systems and their energy. They're also looking at Canada to provide more of their energy needs. But when they look at domestically, they see large millions and millions of hectares of unused farmland. They see a large waste resource from agriculture and forestry that they can pick up and use to make energy, chemicals, materials. And so this is providing one of the big global drivers for moving in this direction.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. David Lazell of BioCap Canada Foundation. I also spoke with Dr. David Keith from Carnegie Mellon University and Dr. Bill Bridger, President and CEO of the Alberta Ingenuity Fund. Highlights from the Climate Change Symposium will soon be posted to the Alberta Ingenuity Fund website. Another conference that recently brought Canadian researchers to Edmonton was that sponsored by the Sustainable Forest Management Network. Marc-André Viard is a professor of biology at Moncton University, and he also did some of his graduate work here in Alberta. I spoke to him about the forest research he's now involved in New Brunswick, on land owned by J.D. Irving.
Well, the work is concentrated in northwestern New Brunswick on private land owned by, in this case, J.D. Irving Limited. Our industrial partner, and so this land is very different from what we would find, for example, in Alberta in the boreal mixedwood forest, in the sense that we also have a mixture of conifers and deciduous, but different species, much more emphasis on high yield silviculture using spruce plantations. Deciduous forest is composed of American beech and sugar maple, mainly with yellow birch. So it's different in that sense, and not a lot of actual mixed wood stands in the landscape.
Now you say that this is privately held land. How large an area is it?
The Blackbrook district where we work is close to 2,000 square kilometers. Very large, and the fact that it's privately owned allows more flexibility in terms of experimental treatments or alternative harvesting practices.
What are some of the things that you're doing?
We have two projects that are related to the Sustainable Forest Management Network, sponsored by, I should say. So one is called Ecological Thresholds in harvesting intensity, and we use avian indicators to determine threshold values or threshold ranges in harvesting intensity beyond which we find a much lower occurrence or probability of reproduction in a number of bird species.
Is it just birds or other things?
The other project goes beyond birds. So what we want to do in the second project is to develop an index of biological integrity. And therefore, we look at a number of different potential indicators of ecological integrity, starting from structures in the stands. So, for example, proportion of large trees and snags, amount of coarse woody material, hollow logs, for example. And then we go to biological indicators, starting with epiphytic lichens, some carabid beetles, and then songbirds, diurnal raptors like hawks and like goshawk, broad-winged hawk, nocturnal raptors, mainly the barred owl. I should have mentioned also pileated woodpecker, black-backed woodpecker, three-toed woodpecker, so a few species of woodpeckers, and the American marten. So those are the potential indicators that we're considering right now, and based on this list, we will develop an index incorporating the best indicators from that list.
Now, this wouldn't be like a natural forest. There's probably been some work already done in there in terms of cutting down and growing back and that sort of thing. What are the challenges then in designing your research?
Well, I wouldn't put it this way, actually. Yes, it's heavily managed. So if you're looking for the pristine reference area or control, then it's a challenge. However, if you view this as a gradient with some old second growth stands as your reference, and then you make use of this wide gradient in harvesting intensity, you can actually find those threshold levels. You can see where the harvesting or silvicultural treatments get too intensive for certain species, or in terms of something like an index. If the index falls at a certain point, it's very useful to know where that point is or where that range is to inform the managers, which can then include biodiversity as a value that they're managing along with forest productivity.
Now, if it is private land, why would they be concerned about things like biodiversity and that?
It turns out that the Blackbrook District is kind of the flagship piece of land owned by the Irving Company, and they want to do the best possible management based on both knowledge of forestry and also knowledge of the ecology. So their objective is to do the best type of management they can do. Of course, it's important for certification purposes, but I think it's also a question of experimenting new ways to do things that won't necessarily affect the volume of wood, but will be smarter over the long term.
Have you found out anything yet?
We have reams of data, of course, but we do find pretty clear threshold ranges in multivariate axis representing harvesting intensity. For example, as you decrease the basal area of larger trees in the stand, yes, you do find that some species have a very sharp decline in their probability of being in a stand or probability of actually showing signs of reproduction in that particular stand. So we can inform the company on those threshold ranges. And we have a number of different species for which we've analyzed these thresholds. And so yes, we are finding things. The study on the index of biological integrity is at the beginning, so we're not at the results stage yet.
You had mentioned that there are pileated woodpeckers. What are some of the things that you're finding there?
Well, first of all, the pileated woodpecker is a crow-sized woodpecker that requires large diameter trees for nesting, for foraging, and also for roosting. So therefore, it's an interesting species to look at. And what we found out is that based on freshly excavated substrates, they seem to have a particular fondness for American beech, which unfortunately has very little commercial value for different reasons, mainly no particular market for its products. So how do we convince the Irving Company to keep a strong beech component, or at least some large beech trees in the stands. That's a tall order, and perhaps we'll have to find ways to develop a market for this species. But it's very clear in our results that they prefer to forage on American beech.
What else needs to be done to really carry this project forward?
Well, I think the acid test of all this is whether or not our results will be clear enough and interesting enough to the company that they will consider incorporating these results into actual ways to harvest the forest, and then monitor the effects of these alternative ways to harvest the forest to see whether they're succeeding at maintaining those species that we found to be indicators or to be sensitive.
When you look at the work that's being done across Canada in terms of sustainable forest management, how does the size of New Brunswick compare to, say, out west in Alberta, where you have such completely different land sizes?
I'm not very good with numbers, but I suspect that the ALPAC FMA is a big chunk of New Brunswick, so to give you a scale. But what's really neat in New Brunswick is that it has such a long history of harvesting compared to other provinces in Canada, like, you know, the boreal forest of Alberta, which is just has recently been started to be harvested. So therefore, we can definitely extend the findings of researchers out west and say, well, you know, if you push the system this far, if you have very intensive silviculture, this is how species X or Y responds. And a lot of those species are actually shared between Alberta and New Brunswick, so we can make those informed speculations. In fact, New Brunswick, I see it pretty much as a microcosm for the larger scale experiment of harvesting across Canada, because it has a longer history, as I said, and the type of harvesting that is conducted is highly influenced by Scandinavian methods, which have proved to be fairly costly in terms of biodiversity. So we're headed somewhere in the same direction, but I think we are making use of the findings of Scandinavian researchers on biodiversity, and hopefully we'll make sure that we don't go as far as they have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Marc-André Viard, a professor of biology at Moncton University in New Brunswick, and a researcher with the Sustainable Forest Management Network, which is hosted by the University of Alberta. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are available as audio files and as written transcripts from our website. The web address is innovationalberta.com. And remember to sign up for the weekly Innovation Alberta online newsletter. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Alberta Ingenuity Fund, Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Conservation Association, the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, University of Lethbridge, National Institute for Nanotechnology, Alberta Research Council, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, True North Energy, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, and the Health Sciences Association of Alberta. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.